Good morning. Apologies, I'm doing kind of double duty today, unfortunately. Beth, our music director, had to go out of town at the last minute. So last week, the week before that, and the next couple of weeks, we're in sort of the reverberations of Easter. And last week, we encountered Thomas. And I know traditionally he's called Doubting Thomas, but as we mentioned last week, if you were here, I think a better title would be Thomas, the one who had reasonable concerns about the claims that his brothers were making, because everyone knows that when people die, they don't come back, which is not nearly as catchy as just Doubting Thomas, so it never sticks. But if last week the word of the day was doubt, and what do we do with doubt? And how doubt itself really isn't maybe the crisis that people sometimes make it out to be. That doubt is just a natural part of faith, because faith is a gift from God anyway. Today, the word of the day, I guess, would be disappointment. So as Luke is telling his version of the story, there's a man named Cleopas. And he's traveling with someone else. Almost certainly it's his wife. And we know that his wife was actually there with Mary, Jesus' mother, watching Jesus die. So whatever their relationship is to Jesus, it's obviously very, very close, even though they're not one of the 12. Excuse me. And so they're making their way towards the village named Emmaus, and interestingly enough, we're not actually sure where that is. But it's obviously some tiny village 7 miles away. That's not a terribly long walk. And they're not having a great weekend, shall we say. And as Jesus shows up incognito, which I just find really funny, he starts asking what they're talking about as if he doesn't already know. Now, as it turns out, Jesus has kind of made a career of doing this, of just asking very, very pointed questions. He very rarely will answer a question directly. Almost always, he responds with another question to take everyone deeper. And so he kind of plays dumb, but says, well, what things are you talking about? And they then explain why. They're experiencing a very deep level of disappointment with God. Because there was a man named Jesus of Nazareth who clearly God was with. He had performed incredible miracles very publicly, which is an important distinction. These were not private events. These were out in the open. He taught very powerfully, and predictably, those in power were very threatened by what he said, and so they got him killed. But they had said, well, we had hoped that he would be the one who would bring about the consolation of Israel. And what they're saying there is actually very expected. They're echoing the hopes and dreams that the people of Judea and Galilee had about the Messiah or the Christ. There's a lot of variation in terms of who people thought the Messiah would be and what he would do in the first century. But the prevailing idea, the general broad idea, is that he will come in. He will be the great William Wallace, just like the great King David, or William Wallace as depicted in the movie, maybe not quite in history, but whatever. And he would kick the Romans out and kill a whole lot of them because they're bad. He would reform the temple and usher back in the presence of God, who would return and be with his people. He would sit on the throne of David, reestablish the boundaries of Israel. It's kind of a tall order. And Jesus did none of that. He didn't reform the temple. He prophetically condemned it, and they had it coming. Was raised up to a throne, but it was a cross, and that was his tortured execution. He didn't reestablish the boundaries of Israel. In fact, he said some very bizarre things to their ears that, no, the kingdom of God is right here. And it has nothing to do with geopolitical boundaries. All of these things can kind of fit from a certain point of view, but not their point of view. And so the fact that Jesus died, just like any other potential Messiah or uprising leader, it just means he wasn't the guy. And clearly they had put a tremendous amount of hope into who Jesus was as they saw it. And this invites us, I think, into a certain kind of reflection about our own lives, our own walk with God as followers of Jesus. Have you ever been like just really disappointed with God? I have. I imagine I'm not alone. And if you find yourself going, no, I've never been disappointed with God, it's worth considering that maybe you feel like you aren't allowed to express that kind of disappointment. Because that kind of disappointment can feel very unsettling to somebody who feels like they have to have it all figured out. Or who maybe grew up in a Christian household, but one that did not talk about things like doubt or confusion or disappointment. Just something to consider. The funny thing, though, is that people are remarkably bad at predicting the things that are going to make them happy, i.e., the things that are not going to disappoint them. There was a study a couple of years ago that looked at people in higher education, so professors, at I think a pretty broad spectrum of universities, and the study particularly worked with people in a teaching position at a university who was about to apply for tenure. Basically, you've published all these things, you've done all these great things for the academic world, and therefore, the university should keep you on more or less indefinitely. You can do whatever you want after that. Not really, but whatever. And what they were tracking was how the expectations of these people and their careers and what they expected being granted this tenureship, or whatever that's called, would do for them. Now, obviously, if you are going through this whole process, you would have a strong sense that once you achieve that, you're going to be happy. You're going to feel fulfilled. Everything's going to be okay. In the findings of this study, they noticed that they were really, really bad at predicting what was actually going to make them happy. Some of them did gain tenure, some of them were denied tenure, and as it turns out, that had no ability to predict their happiness or sense of fulfillment 6 months to a year afterward, which is exactly the opposite of what they expected. And if you think about the way kind of your life has played out, or if as I think about the way my life has played out, that rings true. How many times have we thought, if we can just get to this, if we can achieve this, if I can have this or be in this position, then I will be okay, only to have that be incredibly disappointing or just not work out as I thought. Or every once in a while thinking, wow, this is so much better than what I even expected it to be. But what I'm very interested in this morning, especially as we talk about and meditate on Cleopas and his wife who are wandering out of town because what difference does it make anymore? The guy they hitched their wagon to was apparently not the guy that they had thought he was. Is that we have a tendency to place our sense of fulfillment, our expectations of happiness and joy onto something that we can't control. And then what do we do when, as it turns out, the promises that we thought it had made don't play out. Or to put it again, in terms of Cleopas and his wife as they are wandering to Emmaus, what happens when God disappoints? Our circumstances are not what we had hoped they would be. I thought this job would be great. I'm speaking hypothetically. I'm not talking about this. just FYI. I thought, if I got this job or made this advancement, then I would be fulfilled. It would be okay if I married this person, had these kids, had a family that looked like this, had this status within society, or I had these ideas, thoughts, hopes, and dreams for my state or my city or my nation. And that, it just, you get there and you realize this isn't what I wanted. It's incredibly disappointing. And what I've learned is that, first off, Jesus' capacity to disappoint me is almost infinite. And at the same time, that is an incredibly arrogant thing to say. As if I were the judge of Jesus' decisions. God help us all. And so Jesus seems very aware of what's going on. And I think you can see that in the way that he responds when he starts asking them, "What are you guys talking about?" And they say, "Have you not heard about everything that happened in Jerusalem?" I mean, it's not that big of a city. I mean, at the time, the population, because it was Passover, was probably just like the strict boundaries of Albuquerque, something like that. Word can spread, especially when you've got nothing else to talk about. And so they're shocked that this guy doesn't know. And then Jesus, rather than saying, "I'm that guy," or, "Oh, no, you missed the point, let me explain," rather he invites them deeper. What thing? And then in response, after they explain what happened, he says, "Foolish ones and slow of heart." He's not calling them fools. That language is not as harsh as it may sound. Instead, he's just saying, "You guys have missed it." And as we've known, if you're familiar with the stories of Jesus, you'll know that basically everybody misses it. And so then he explains, but he doesn't say, "Look, I'm the guy, see?" Like, he doesn't pull a Thomas and say, "Look, see, ta-da." Instead, he tells a story. But he tells the story of their people in a different way, and in a way that basically nobody understood at this point. We would love to have known the details of what he said to them. And in fact, I'm not sure if it works like this, but if, you know, after the resurrection and renewal of all things, if I encounter Luke, we're going to have a long conversation about filling in details. But, again, what a deeply arrogant thing to say. But at the very least, what we can tell is that he starts in the beginning. And rather than telling a story of disappointment and destruction, which is the story of Israel, ancient Israel, it is a story of constantly missing the point, of being handed everything and then dropping it and going and, you know, finding somebody else to worship. In other words, it's really the story of humanity. That rather than telling it as a story of disappointment and destruction, he retells it as a story of redemption. Weaving together all of the different moments of their great history, how maybe like Passover, which they had just finished celebrating, the blood of the lamb put on the doorpost means that death is averted. Well, let me tell you about whose blood that actually was. The story of Abraham, Father Abraham, who was asked to sacrifice his son, his one and only son. And that, by the way, is a direct quote from Genesis. Well, let me tell you about the one and only son who actually did give up his life. Or to take it deeper, how the prophets had constantly pleaded with the people, saying, like, look, you're missing the point. God doesn't want the empty ritual if you're oppressing those that he has commanded you to love. And there will be some consequences if you don't live up to that. Well, let me tell you about the one who took on the mantle of Israel and did exactly what God had commanded him to do. You can see how this retelling over their 7-mile walk to some small village could really change their lives. And there's something to be said about telling a story of hope. Why are some of the most important stories our culture tells, especially like our movies, our books, things like that, that really, really move people? Why is it that those movies, stories, whatever, tend to be stories of redemption and hope? Or to put it in words of Luke 24, why do they sometimes cause a burning within us? Because they tap into something that we all desperately crave. And that is an answer to the disappointment that many of us feel as we just go through our lives. Now, I'm not saying all of life is doom and destruction, all of life is terrible. What I am saying is that sometimes life can be terrible. Sometimes life can be immensely disappointing. Sometimes God makes choices that we would not, again, what an arrogant thing to say. At the same time, they still create a sense of frustration and disappointment that is all quite real. And then when we hear a story, whether it is just being told by our culture or we come to church and learn that maybe this isn't exactly how things are really, why does that have a tendency to move us? And I think the answer is that we know somewhere deep down, things could be better. My experience, and I highly suspect I'm not the only one, is that my idea of how things could be better tends not to align with God's redemptive plan of my life and everyone else's life who follows him. And his story that he is telling of redemption is so much better. Imagine if Cleopas and I assume anyway, his wife, imagine they got what they wanted. Jesus as Messiah or Christ does exactly what they had hoped for. Reestablish the nation of Israel, the ancient nation of Israel, sits on the throne of David. And imagine Jesus wasn't the Son of God, because this may sound strange. At that point, nobody expected that the Messiah would be the divine Son of God. That comes after. What would they get? They would get a human being on the throne, ruling over the nation, and historically that has not gone well for them. What if all your hopes and dreams for your life were met? What would you do when you discover that it's not what you thought it would be? I said this, in the last month or two, and it pains me to say that I'm quoting Jim Carrey as a source of wisdom, but whatever. He has once said that he hopes that people have the opportunity to get everything they've ever wanted, because then they'll realize how disappointing it is. Now, that can be depressing. Or it can change us. because a story where somebody just gets what they want after a lot of hard work, or they get lucky and they get what they want and life works out the way they want, is not a kind of story that moves us. It doesn't draw us deeper into what God has for us. It's just some bratty person who got what they want. But a story of redemption, of transformation, a story of going through the disappointment, only to discover that God is telling a much different story, and the story that he is telling in us and through us is so much better. Because those stories take seriously the hard moments of life. The moments where we can't find hope to save our lives, only to discover that hope was with us the entire time. That is, by the way, is another way of explaining what Easter morning really is. When everything has fallen apart, we realize we have nothing, nothing to offer God, nothing to offer ourselves or those around us, only to be reminded that it is Jesus who has defeated death. And not only defeated death, but he's defeated the death within us, the death that we inflict upon ourselves and those around us, to tell a story of real change, of real transformation, that actually isn't dependent on circumstances. It isn't maybe even dependent on relationships that we have, as hard as that can be to understand or wrap our minds or experience around. That's the kind of hope that sticks with you. That's the kind of hope that changes history. It's the kind of hope that actually isn't shaken or destroyed or burnt to the ground when God supposedly disappoints us. Because it gives us a bigger perspective, a bigger sense of this much larger story that God has drawn us into. That may have started with in the beginning and worked its way through Abraham and Moses and the prophets and so on and so forth, but ultimately begins for us on Good Friday, when a perfect, innocent victim goes to his grave in exchange for us, only to find out that even death itself is not contained. It is not strong enough to hold him down. Now suddenly the things that we encounter in our lives are much smaller than they feel. The disappointment in God that we experience is maybe just kind of silly, naive human thought for which God is strangely patient for. Because his heart and his desire is to tell a different kind of story in our lives. That's really, really good news. And I think as that all comes together, it's apparent why Cleopas and his wife, as they are talking to themselves after their guest or their new friend just vanishes in front of them, saying, man, our hearts, they were burning as he explained all of that. That's real hope. And when you do that, maybe even me can be motivated to run 7 miles. Probably not, though. And so when they imagine the moment when they get back to the rest of the disciples saying, it's all true. We saw him, and he is made known to us in the breaking of bread. And I'll leave you with this. Luke is very intentional about drawing that story together. Because what he's saying is that this story of redemption, the story of the transformation of disappointment in God to this trust and hope, that he is telling a much better story than what we think, can be experienced in the eating of that broken bread which, as I'm sure many of you will make the connection, is Jesus' body. As we receive the sacrament in a few moments, we are receiving a tangible, tasteable element of the story of redemption that Jesus is telling through his own death and resurrection. My prayer is that in that invitation into a story of hope and transformation, we are likewise engaging in the stories of disappointment with God, being encouraged that all disappointment with God can find hope. Amen. As you are able, please rise.